It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Hello, my name is Randy Mork, and welcome to the Great War Podcast, episode number one. World War I was a turning point that showed us the dark side of what industrialization was capable of. A century before the start of the war in 1914, most Western Europeans would say the big battle was Waterloo. There were 51,000 casualties during that one-day battle. 100 years later, with the aid of industrialization, you have machines putting together as many cannon shells and bullets as quick as you can feed them. That means that you can lob that much more steel at your enemy, be it in the form of artillery fire, machine guns, or something new your country creates to more efficiently win the war. Remember how there was 51,000 casualties of all countries involved at Waterloo? Well, 99 years later, during the starting day of the Somme battle, the British would spend 57,000 young men. That's just the British casualties for the first day. The Somme battle would continue till November of 1916, and just the Allied losses would be 623,000 men. My goal for this podcast is to bring to life the change that happened at the beginning of the last century. After all, those who don't learn from their mistakes are doomed to repeat them. I'm going to try to publish once a month and just see where this goes. Please leave me a post on the blog with any errors or advice at www.thegreatwarpodcast.com. I'm creating this while trying to work a job, and I'm just an amateur, so please feel free to set me straight. Without any further ado, let's jump into the story. In 1914, most people thought that a large-scale and long-term European war was just not possible. Europe's economy was tightly intertwined, and a war between two large powers would bring enough economic tribulation that both sides would soon be at the peace table. Europe, since the Napoleonic Wars, had been hard at work redressing the balance of power that had led to those wars. They had created a new country called Belgium out of some of the area that the European countries had fought over in the previous century. They had also legitimized the existence of smaller nations that had thrown off the yoke of the Ottomans during their decline, such as Serbia. Most countries also had royal families that were related to almost all of the remaining European ruling class. You can't tell the story of World War I without looking into the history of the major combatants to find out what drives a country to sacrifice nearly a whole generation of its young men, and then to keep killing them for the next 4 years. Let's start with France. During the 3rd century AD, half of a Germanic tribe named the Franks moved westward over the Rhine into what was part of the Roman Empire. Some of them raided and others worked with the Romans. By 357 AD, the Romans recognized Frankish independence. After the collapse of the Roman Empire, they set out to rein in all of the outlying areas until by the 6th century, they had conquered most of what would become modern-day France. The Western Franks merged with what was left of the Roman citizenry and developed close ties with the Church of Rome. They survived and intermarried with the native Gauls and the Vikings that came raiding later. All this served to change them from the rough barbarians that came over the Rhine all those years ago to a nation most of Christendom looked to. In 1914, France was led by President Raymond Poincaré. He held the office from 1913 to 1920, and was a moderate Republican who wasn't afraid to voice his anti-German opinions. He also was a strong proponent of Franco-Russian cooperation. Turning to the Germans, remember all those Germans lurking in their forests just over the Rhine and the Danube? The ones that didn't migrate slash pillage and settle Gaul? Let's take a quick look at them to see how the Germany of 1914 came together. The North German Confederation was a group of states led by the Kingdom of Prussia that went to war with France in July of 1870. This confederation was between 22 different Germanic states. However, the southern Germanic states did not sign the treaty joining the confederation. Prussian Chancellor Otto von Bismarck engineered a war between France and what would become Germany in order to draw the southern Germanic states into the North Germanic Confederation. His idea was to scare the southern Germanic-speaking states into the North German Confederation. Without going too far off track, the Prussian-led coalition smashed the French at Sedan and brought the southern Germanic states into the fold in 1870, forming the German Empire. By 1914, the German leadership was still mainly made up of the militaristic and aggressive Prussian aristocracy. The Germans in 1914 were led by Kaiser Wilhelm II. He ascended the throne in 1888 and was known for being a bellicose and impetuous leader. Wilhelm was born with a left arm that was 6 inches shorter than his right arm. Most people speculate that the desire to make up for his withered left arm made him a more aggressive leader. He had a desire to prove himself against his cousins. Didn't bring that up yet, did I? Yep. Nicholas II, his wife, King George V, and Kaiser Wilhelm were all first or second cousins. Much of the rest of the European royalty was related, but that goes beyond what we need to go over. Just wanted to give the listener an idea of how intermarried Europe was. It seems that some of them were on good terms, though. Nicholas II and Wilhelm II called each other Nicky and Willy in their private letters. Either that or they were being pretty snarky to each other. The sun never set on the British Empire during this time period. They had colonies circumnavigating the globe. Great Britain, much like Germany, was a country that knew its business. As an island nation that ruled overseas trading empire, they realized a large professional navy would have to be a priority. Britain put such emphasis on their navy that their building policy required them to have enough ships to beat any two major nations that they might go to war with. A small yet very professional mobile land army was also kept by the British, mostly to keep the peace in their colonies. The British land army was, in my opinion, the best at the onset of the war. Great Britain was led by Prime Minister Herbert Asquith. He was a liberal who had spearheaded and won quite a few reforms in pre-war Britain. However, during the war, he became increasingly unsteady and vacillating. He would be replaced in 1916 by a man called David Lloyd George. Russia, in the first decade of the 20th century, was very, very scary on paper. They had the largest army in Europe and the largest manpower reserves. The problem was, they were usually led by incompetent officers. When thinking about Russia at the beginning of the war, remember this. It was only 100-ish years before this that Napoleon invaded Russia. There weren't enough muskets to go around, so a large proportion of the Russian soldiery got a pike to defend himself with. This was because they didn't have the manufacturing capacity of other nations. They were economically backwards compared to the Western European countries. This would hold true in 1914 as it did in 1812. Now, a pike is just a really long spear. The idea was for all of your soldiers to stand in a square. Then everyone would advance towards the enemy while keeping formation and try to poke the other guy with your sharp stick. In 1914, the average peasant soldier that was lucky enough to be issued a rifle had a bayonet that was welded to the barrel. This would, in theory, keep the peasant soldier from losing them, and they wouldn't have to fumble for them when it was time to gloriously charge the machine guns. It doesn't sound that bad, you say? The Model 91 Imperial Russian rifle was 51.5 inches long from buttstock to the end of the barrel. And then you add that bayonet that's welded on there, that's another 18 inches. So now we have a rifle that's 69.5 inches long. I've seen statistics that say the average male in 1914 was between 55 inches and 68.25 inches tall. Now you're getting how the Russian officer class looked at the Russian peasant soldier. Just another pikeman. The Russians were led by Tsar Nicholas II. He was born in 1868 and would ascend to the throne in 1896. Therefore, he had 18 years leading his country under his belt by the time they went to war. The problem was that his father, Alexander III, failed to prepare him for leadership, as his health failed unexpectedly. Thrust into the Russian royal court, Nicholas was surrounded by sycophants. This was also a time when the royalty of a country was expected to command men during war maneuvers. War maneuvers were war drills the armies would go through. The army would be split up, and one side would be led by a military leader, and the other would be led by available royalty. That royalty usually won the maneuvers, not necessarily out of skill, though. Thus, Nicholas II thought he was pretty handy in a battle. In 1299, the Ottoman state was formed by Osman Bey. It was an Islamic nation and grew till 1453. It became an empire with its conquest of Constantinople. Constantinople was a traditional bulwark against Islamic invasion of Europe from Eastern Asia. During the reign of Solomon the Magnificent from 1520 to 1566, they conquered as far as Hungary and also captured Belgrade. The high water mark for the Ottoman Empire was their siege of Vienna, which they tried and failed at several times. 1566 is considered the high water mark for the Ottomans, and over the next several centuries, due to incompetent rulers, their power slowly wanes. Let's bring on the Austro-Hungarians, our last guest for the list of major players for this month. Austria-Hungary, or the dual monarchy, was formed in 1867 between Austria, Hungary, and Croatia. They also had parts of Italy, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. Austria was Germanic, Hungary was dominated by people of Turkic descent called the Magyars. You also have Slavs, Croats, and Muslims. All of these don't really have much to unify them anymore. After all, the Ottoman Empire is in the decline. Everyone knew they weren't going to have to worry about them trying to conquer the world as they did just a few centuries before this. Since the Ottomans were in the decline, many Western nations decided to set up some new Balkan states, some independent like Serbia and some not like Bosnia, which the Austro-Hungarians annexed according to the same treaty that created Serbia. After they became a state, Serbia started out being heavily influenced by the Austro-Hungarians. After a palace coup in 1903, however, the new leadership began to lean towards Russia's sphere of influence. Serbia would go to war with the Ottomans in 1912 and the Bulgarians in 1913 and win both wars against a far larger army. The effects of modern artillery and machine guns were obvious, but most people chose not to see what that meant for a war in Western Europe. This was just some war in a backwater country to most people. Serbia's victories gave rise to a nationalist movement for a Serb, Croat, and Bosnian South Slav state called Yugoslavia. This state would be carved out of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Their only problem is the Austro-Hungarians probably wouldn't want them to succeed in this. Think of it from the Austro-Hungarian point of view. If all these small people groups could break off and form a new nation, what's to happen to our own hugely inefficient and grossly incompetent government? Archduke Franz Ferdinand was in line for the crown of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His uncle was the Emperor Franz Joseph, the leader of the country. He was ordered by his uncle to attend some military maneuvers in Bosnia. After that, he and his wife Sophie decided to attend a museum opening in Sarajevo. Now that we've introduced Sophie, let's do some background on her and look at the first great tragedy of the war. You see, Franz Ferdinand showed more class than the rest of the European royalty, and had he lived, he just might have been the man to avert disaster. Sophie was a Czech countess, and as such, she had a much lower social standing than her own in-laws. She had to sit at the foot of the table farthest from her husband at dinner. When there was a royal ball, she had to enter the room only after all other guests of higher social standing entered. Franz Joseph, the emperor, only agreed to her marrying Franz Ferdinand after it was agreed their offspring would never sit in the throne. This poor girl couldn't even sit next to him on any public occasion. There was an exception to the not sitting next to each other rule, though. If the Archduke was in his official military capacity, then he could sit side by side with his wife in public. He would be able to honor her as she deserved as his wife instead of according to tradition. So, since Franz Ferdinand would be attending military maneuvers in Bosnia anyway, why not bring the wife and visit Sarajevo? Gavrilo Princip was 19 years old in June of 1914. He was a Bosnian Serb who wanted to see a state independent of the Austrian setup called Yugoslavia. 2 years before, he was kicked out of school for organizing demonstrations against the Austro-Hungarians. A classmate would later recall Princip going from class to class threatening the students with his knuckle duster if they didn't attend the demonstrations. After he was kicked out of school, Princip went to Belgrade in independent Serbia, where he tried to join the Serbian army to help track Ottoman Turkish raiders. Instead, he got hooked up with a group called Young Bosnia, a revolutionary group that trained in independent Serbia. June 28th of 1914 found Princip back in Sarajevo. He and his team had planned to assassinate the governor of Bosnia, but changed the target to Franz Ferdinand. After delays in getting the team armed, they were presented with the opportunity to kill the Archduke. It was a nice summer day, and the royal couple was scheduled to visit a military barracks in Sarajevo that morning. Security was lax, and Princip and his team were able to get into position along the route easily. The conspirators were armed with bombs and handguns. Ferdinand's motorcade passed several of the conspirators before one got up the courage to throw his bomb at the Archduke. The bomb bounced off the trunk and blew up underneath the car that was trailing them. Princip failed to act as the motorcade sped away towards the town hall. Once there, Ferdinand chewed out the mayor for a while till Sophie whispered something in his ear. At this, he regained his composure and told the mayor, "Now you may speak," in reference to the speech the mayor had prepared. The Archduke was supposed to speak first, but his speech was covered in blood as it was in the car that had been trailing them. After the town hall visit, Ferdinand and Sophie decided to visit the policeman that had been riding in the bombed car, thus setting in motion an almost unbelievable chain of events. With their decision to visit the hospital made, the couple set off. They were riding in the third car in line, with a Count Harak riding on the left-hand running board as security. Remember though, this wasn't their original plan. This visiting the policeman in the hospital was a new development. Plus, the royal couple were getting bombs thrown at them, and yet had to keep their demeanor. You couldn't lose your cool in front of the commoners just because people were trying to blow you up. Meanwhile, Princip decided to try to kill the Archduke on his way back and had taken up station in front of a delicatessen. The convoy drivers were not informed of the change of destination by the time of their departure, and they pulled over on Franz Josef Street to clarify their destination. Unbeknownst to them, Princip was standing in the crowd by the now stationary vehicles. He pulled out a .380 caliber handgun supplied to him by the Serbs and fired two shots, one hitting Franz Ferdinand in the neck and the other hitting the Countess Sophie in the abdomen. Princip was immediately arrested. The couple both died on their way to the governor's mansion for medical treatment. Reportedly, Franz Ferdinand's last words were, "Sophie, Sophie, don't die. Live for our children." They had to be buried in a castle graveyard. Sophie's social status would not let them be buried in the royal crypt. They were interred on the 4th of July. And this is really where the story starts to take shape. This next time period is called the July Crisis. Of course, it didn't take long for the Austro-Hungarians to figure out who supplied Princip the weapons. The day after the assassination, the Austro-Hungarians were sending dispatches to each other suggesting Serbian complicity in the killing. Already on the 9th of July, the Emperor was receiving reports on the investigation into Serbian assistance in the assassination. A few days later, on the 13th, they learned of a projected Serbian attack. Now, personally, I think the projected Serbian attack was Austro-Hungarian propaganda, given that the Serbs didn't order mobilization until the 25th of July, 2 days after the Austro-Hungarians had given the Serbs their ultimatum. The ultimatum the Austro-Hungarians sent included these things: the removal and prohibition of anti-Austro-Hungarian propaganda, the removal of anti-Austro-Hungarian teachers, the removal of any anti-Austro-Hungarian military officers, and these could be named by the Austro-Hungarians also, to accept representatives of the Austro-Hungarians in Serbia for the purpose of prosecuting the people responsible for the June 28th plot. The list of demands goes on for quite a while. The Serbs agree to everything except for a couple of points. Nevertheless, the Austro-Hungarians would declare war a few days later. So this is the point where the world really starts to go crazy. After all, they had seen the carnage of the Russo-Japanese War and the two Serbian Wars. They knew what modern machine guns and quick-firing artillery could do to the human body. yet they convinced themselves that their particular experience would be different, either because they're cited soldiers that had more heart, better training, better leadership, the list goes on and on. Point is, they were all wrong. Back to the 23rd, and let's look at the story of the string of events that led the world into the madness of the First World War. The 23rd was the day the Austro-Hungarians gave their ultimatum to Serbia. Serbia was a mainly a Slavic nation, as we talked about earlier. It had been gravitating towards the Russian sphere of influence since the coup of 1903. Russia is a nation mostly comprised of people of Slavic descent. After receiving the Austro-Hungarian ultimatum, Serbia appealed to the Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, on the 24th of July. In response, 2 days later, the Tsar declared that Russia would mobilize on the Austrian frontier if Austria attacked Serbia. In response to the Russian declaration on the 26th, the Germans, who were the Austro-Hungarians' allies, declared they would partially mobilize if the Russians did not back down. So, for those of you that don't know, mobilization is tantamount to war. It's just that the shooting hasn't started yet. Mobilization is when you order all of your reserves to active duty, thereby costing you a lot of money and energy. Mobilization wasn't a word a nation tossed around lightly. In spite of this, the Russians still were sending telegrams to the Austro-Hungarian capital of Vienna suggesting talks as late as the 27th of July. Germany would claim she knew nothing of this, but had looked to negotiations herself. So now we have Austria, Germany, Serbia, and Russia threatening each other. On the 27th, the Tsar wired the Serbians in Belgrade, stating he couldn't be indifferent to Serbia's fate. The next day, on the 28th, the Austrians declared war on Serbia. Remember that the war that the world would be in wouldn't be like the ones their fathers were in. The wars their fathers fought were more Napoleonic, where lines of men would march at each other, fire their rifles, and then charge in with bayonets affixed. Probably the most devastating thing that could happen to you would be someone on the opposing side would fire grapeshot at you. Grapeshot was when a single cannon would fire multiple small balls at once. It's also known as canister shot, and because of its low velocity, also has a relatively short range. Now, their sons were supposed to use the same tactics to defeat modern quick-firing artillery and machine guns. Most of their commanders thought that with enough courage and elan, you could bayonet charge machine gun nests. Back to the story. On the 29th of July, the Germans notified the Russians that the partial mobilization, they, being the Germans, had been threatened, had to be followed by war with Russia. In response, the Tsar ordered a full mobilization. In the afternoon, Austrian gunboats on the Danube started bombarding Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. The next day, the Germans would announce they would be mobilizing fully, followed by the Russians starting theirs on the 31st, as well as the Austrians ordering a general mobilization on the same day. This same day, the 31st, the Germans demanded of the French to know their stance on the war. Now, the French had a mutual assistance treaty with the Russians. In response, the French announced they would protect their interests. The Ottomans ordered mobilization for the same day. The French ordered mobilization at 3:40 the following afternoon. The Belgians announced mobilization for the same day. This same day, on the 1st, is when the Germans declared war on Russia. They claimed Russian troops had already crossed their northern border. So now Germany is at war with Russia to the east and north, and has France mobilizing to its west. Austro-Hungary is at war with Serbia. Italy declines to enter the war, as it is an aggressive one, and her treaty with Germany and Austria are for a defensive war. And soon, events are going to play out that bring Great Britain into the war, but that needs to wait for a bit. Here is where I'd like to go into more depth about plans and war aims of the different combatants. The Schlieffen Plan was created by Count Alfred von Schlieffen in 1905. In the opening part of this entry, the German countries were divided into the Allies, being Russia, France, and Great Britain, and the Triple Entente, being Italy, Austro-Hungary, and Germany. The Schlieffen Plan was created by Count Alfred von Schlieffen in 1905. In the opening part of the century, the European countries were divided into the Allies, being Russia, France, and Great Britain, and the Triple Entente, being Italy, Austro-Hungary, and the Germans. Schlieffen expected the French to be the bigger threat, as the French had more industrialized country, a more compact area to mobilize troops to, and a vastly more efficient transportation system than the Russians. Therefore, the French would be able to punch first. The German border with France was mostly mountainous, but to the north they had a border with Luxembourg and then Belgium that was mostly flat. The French border also had poor road access compared with the northern route via Belgium. There would be enough troops stationed in the east to hold the Russians back for a while. The Kaiser's troops would invade through Belgium to get at France. The Germans figured they had about 6 weeks to break into and finish off France before the Russians could mobilize enough to threaten the east. This plan relied on the British rolling over on their guarantee of Belgian sovereignty, though. In 1839, the major European powers got together inside the Treaty of London, which recognized Belgium as a nation, and also German-speaking Luxembourg. This was done to redress the power vacuum that was left in Europe after Napoleon. In this treaty, Great Britain pledged to defend Belgium's neutrality, since the area that Belgium holds is one of the more strategic areas for invading troops. The French had planned 17. It was created in 1913 by General Joseph Joffre. We'll talk more about him later. Plan 17 called for a general French offensive in Belgium. They would advance into an area of Germany called Alsace-Lorraine. This area was taken from the French during the Franco-Prussian War. The French plans also called for advancing into Belgium to meet the Germans. This was due to the French attributing their loss in the Franco-Prussian War to fight on the defensive behind fortifications. The Austrians had a plan called B, which stood for Balkans. I haven't been able to find out much about it other than it called for 3 armies to guard on the Russian frontier, while another 3 crossed the Danube into Belgrade and stomped a mud hole in Serbia. Russia had planned 19. It called for 2 Russian armies to advance into North Prussia on their way to Central Germany. All other Russian units would defend against Austrian and German counterattack. So now that we've gone over the basic strategies of the armies, we can continue on with the timeline. On the 2nd of August, the Germans began their invasion of Luxembourg with the aim of rolling up through Belgium and into France. At 7 p.m., the Germans sent a telegram to Belgium telling them they must invade their country in order to meet the French that would be invading from the other direction. They demanded the Belgians remain neutral while their army walked through their country. They required an answer within 12 hours. The next morning at 7 o'clock, the Belgians refused the German demands and immediately sent appeals to the British government for help. Later on the day of the 3rd, Great Britain orders mobilization over the planned German invasion of Belgium. This day, the British sent an ultimatum to Germany that expires on the 4th. The ultimatum requires the Germans to respect Belgian sovereignty. During August 4th, the British protest the planned invasion of Belgium to the Germans. In response, the Germans claim that the French had intended on violating Belgian territory. German troops have already crossed the Belgian border and started their preparatory attacks on the fortress at Liège. In response to the British protest, the Germans declare official war on the Belgians. By the deadline of 11 o'clock at night on the 4th, the British were at war with Germany. By this time, the cat was out of the bag. There wasn't any coming back. Sir Edward Grey was the British Foreign Secretary till 1916. He has been accused of helping the world descend into war by inactivity and misrepresenting his country during the months leading up to war. He didn't intervene with the Serbians and Austrians, and the Germans came away from meetings with him thinking the British would not intervene in Belgium. That being said, I think by the end he was picking up on how bad it would get. He commented on the night that the ultimatum to Germany was due, quote, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." Now it's the 4th of August. If I forgot a country's war declaration or the day they mobilized, please forgive me. Let's clarify, though. Russia, France, Belgium, and Great Britain are at war with Germany and Austria-Hungary. German troops have overrun Luxembourg and are starting to reduce the defenses designed to keep Belgium safe. In the east, we have the Austrians shelling Belgrade and Serbia and trying to cross the Danube to enter that city. Everyone else is still trying to get their armies together and to their jumping-off points. back to the Belgian fortifications for a minute. You remember how Belgium was a tactically sound investment for anyone planning an invasion of Europe? This was for its flat ground and numerous roads. Well, the Belgians also knew this and had built fortresses around the cities of Liège and Namur, hoping to block the invasion routes from the east and the west. In Liège, the forts were built in 1892 by Europe's leading fortification designer, Henri Alexis Bouillemont. There were 12 forts spread out in a ring around the city. They were about 2.5 miles apart so that they could support each other with fire. However, they were designed for outward defense, not an all-around defense. Now, the Belgians had built some impressive defenses around the city. The forts held up to the Germans for 2 days after they arrived in forts. Now, the Belgians had built some impressive defenses around the city. The forts held up to the Germans for 2 days after they arrived in force. The holdup was due to the Germans having difficulties bringing their heavy artillery pieces up. With advances in tooling over the preceding decades, we have the capability to make some really, really big guns. Krupp made a mortar that was 17 inches wide, the shells weighed 1,800 pounds, and the shells were the brass case, projectile, powder, and anything else that comprised the ammunition. It could fire at targets at almost 8 miles away. Just the generation before this, artillerymen usually fired on targets that could be seen. You just shot cannonballs at them till they got close enough for you to swap to grape shot. To fire at targets you couldn't see was considered a waste. By 1914, you had factories that could churn out shells at unbelievable rates compared to your dad's artillery of 1865. The advances in tooling also led to artillerymen being able to fire at targets unseen with much more accuracy. For those of you that don't know, a mortar shoots a projectile up very high. Then gravity eventually takes over and pulls the projectile back towards its target. It was one of the Krupp cannons that the Germans would use later in the war to bombard Paris. During those shots, the Germans would have to calculate the rotation of the earth to predict where the shots would land, as the projectile could travel 81 miles. That's how far the world came in the preceding 50 years or so. So the Germans dragged these huge mortars up to within range of the holdout Belgian forts, yet out of range of the Belgian guns. One after another, the forts were broken down. It would take another 8 days before the Germans smashed the way through. All this was due to one of those Prussian leaders that the Germans had during the war. His name was Erich Ludendorff, and his star was just rising. Ludendorff was sent as a replacement for a unit fighting in Liège that had lost its general. This was on the 5th of August. The Germans had already lost thousands in frontal assaults against the fortifications. He took command and called for siege guns as a priority. By the 16th, the forts had all surrendered. I think I read somewhere that he personally walked up to the last fort and banged on its entrance with his sword hilt to demand the holdout surrender. You gotta love those old-time Prussians. He would move on to Namur and start taking those forts before he would be called east to face an unexpected threat, though. I'm gonna end this podcast here. Next time, we'll cover how the threat in the East played out, how Germany dealt with it, and we'll see the first British troops in France and the French themselves getting into it with the Germans. Oh, and I wonder, what's going on with those big, bad Austro-Hungarians? I bet they're really kicking those tiny Serbians, right? Thank you for listening.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the